Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Well, MotoGP has been and gone from Austin, Texas, and I think it's safe to say we got the good, the bad, and the ugly from Marc Marquez over this weekend. Welcome back to Tank Slappers. I'm your host, Dre Harrison, here on the Motorsport Network. Thank you very much for joining us for another episode as ever. And we've just had round three of the MotoGP World Championship from the Circuit of the Americas in Austin, Texas. And, well, we've just had another one of those crazy, chaotic, iconic, however you want to describe it, moments in MotoGP where the rule book kind of gets torn up and chaos ensued. And that was just off the start. So here to make some sense of it all and break down what happened and what happens next in regards to all of that is my colleague, Mr. Yuri Pudjemon. How you doing, sir?
I'm good. A bit tired, about which I think it's understandable after what happened, all what happened on Sunday. But yeah, happy to jump on the podcast, and also it's super good that we always have new stories to talk about. And yeah, I mean, I would say that Austin was an eventful Grand Prix.
For a split second, I was worried we were going to have three straight weekends of Marc Marquez dominating everything and we'd be running out of things to talk about already. But
you see?
But Marc instead gave us another way of talking about this race. And, well, we're going to go right from the top. I call it the Marc Marquez experience. The man has found new and exciting ways of spicing things up going into a round we all thought he was going to dominate. And he was looking like he was going to dominate this race. I mean, pole for the eighth time, won the sprint race reasonably comfortable after that crazy first lap. If you haven't seen that first lap of the sprint, by the way, go out of your way to find it. Absolutely ridiculous first lap. Marc Marquez goes from almost losing the rear of his bike and completely getting chucked off it to passing two bikes in one corner, two corners later. Only Marc could have pulled that off. But I wanted to focus on the Grand Prix start. Now, let's picture the scene a little bit here. It's just rained. If you're a fan of the junior classes, Moto 3 was dry, but Moto 2 was wet. It was a wet race that was dominated by Jake Dixon. A shout out to Jake for all your British colleagues out there. Dominated, led from start to finish. But what was interesting was in the Moto 2 race was that we had a few riders like Manuel Gonzalez gamble on the slick tire. It didn't work out, but by the end of the race, they were lapping just as fast as the wet runners were, which left the intrigue open. I mean, because the Moto 2 race finishes roughly about an hour before the Moto GP race starts. You get that little TV window you get to set up the race itself. So it stopped raining. The track is drying out. But it's still right in the middle between dry tires and wet tires. So much so, Fabio Quartararo actually crashes on the sighting lap on the way to the grid. He was on slicks, thought it was slick weather, not quite there. But the track in Austin dries so fast that by the time we actually got to within a few minutes of the race start, it's basically a dry line where it's important. There's a dry line on the track itself. Yuri's nodding his head with me as I say this. It's all good so far as me trying to explain this.
100%.
Good. I'm glad we're off to a good start. Now, this is where it gets a little bit crazy. With, I want to say, seconds before the warm-up lap starts, and I don't know if you saw this in the media center, Yuri, but they were playing the intros. We watch in the UK, we watch on TNT Sports, and they were showing the light boxy intro for the MotoGP race, the big long intro. They actually cut it halfway through, and next thing you know, you'll see Marc Marquez running through the pit lane to get to his dry bike. And multiple riders now following him through, sprinting down the pit lane to tend to their second bike. Now, a wet race had already been declared, which means you can change bikes at any time. That was, we found out about half an hour before the race start itself that was going to happen, Yuri. But Mark, and we've now seen the video of this since, explaining it in a bit more detail from the actual key players involved. I think Marco Rigamonti, as well as chief mechanic, was a key part of the conversation. You know, so what was going through Mark's mind in the minutes leading up to that now viral switch?
Well, I think, thank you for the explanation and for the intro. I think it's spotless. But I think what is important here is that Mark and the rest of the grid realized, let's say, 4-5 minutes before starting the warm-up lap, that they were with the wrong tires. It's important here to let people understand that once you start the sighting lap, the one where Fabio crashed, the sighting lap is the one going to the grid for the first time after the pit lane is open. So it's about, let's say, 20-25 minutes before the race. Once you enter the grid with, let's say, a configuration, let's put wet tires on the bike, those are the ones you need to keep for the race unless you're having a penalty, okay? So when Mark starts running to the pit lane, it was because he knew and so the rest of the grid did that he was with the wrong tires. Apart from Enea Bastianini, Ayogura, and Brad Binder, they were the three only riders on the grid with the right tires, which means slick tires, mm-hmm. for those conditions. Okay. What else? What Mark thought is, okay, first, I need to change bike. So the best way to being able and to pay the less is that most of the riders will follow me and they will probably, we will create a situation of, let's say, chaos or something like that. So redirection will show the red flag, which means that the race is neutralized, and then we're starting from scratch. Mm-hmm. Okay. What he was wrong about is the penalty itself. He thought that he was going to start the last on the grid, and that was going to be it. But after the Japanese Grand Prix of last year, there was a change in the regulations. And by doing that, by changing from wet to dry or from dry to wet, the new penalty says that you will start from your grid position and then you will have to do a right through. What happened? That the red flag invalidates everything.
So it's basically like that whole start didn't happen, basically.
Exactly, exactly. So it was good for Mark, despite he was wrong on his judgment about what he was going to have to do.
Yeah, if you, again, I don't normally recommend videos, but if you haven't seen MotoGP.com's video on the full in-depth,
it's an outstanding document.
Yeah, it's a fantastic video. I highly recommend you go out of your way to see it because it has the full in-depth conversation that Marc Márquez has with Marco Rigamonti, his chief mechanic, on the grid. They're deliberately trying to plot this out and figure out a, because you could tell Márquez had a plan. The plan was basically swap at the absolute last minute, try and catch some people out, you know, he's able to change onto a dry bike. It'll just come through from what he thinks is the back of the grid and then pass everybody anyway and go on to win. When in actuality, because there was confusion, you could tell there was confusion in the Ducati camp with Rigamonti, Davide Tardozzi's in said video. They're all trying to figure out, wait, is it the back of the grid or is it a ride through penalty?
Well, I would say that, I mean, Davide Tardozzi was the only one right.
Mm.
But also, when you have a rider like Marc Márquez saying that he was 100% sure that his penalty would have been starting from the back of the grid, well, even to me, to everybody says, okay, if you are 100% sure. But on that footage you just mentioned, Davide says it's a right through. So, of course, it was all last minute with all the tension super high, so it's understandable. But in the end, nothing happened because of that red flag.
Yeah. What Mark, and again, a shout out to the Spanish MotoGP team that ended up putting this all on the website as well, motorsport.com. You can read all the coverage on that incident. What Mark was hoping for was that another rule, the article 1.18.4, I think it is, that yes, kicks in, that where the rule, I believe, goes that if 10 riders abandon their post.
Riders.
Oh, yeah. Right. I think it's if 10 riders abandon their grid slots, the start is automatically aborted. And while he didn't get to 10, Mike Webb, the race director, saw obviously quite a potentially dangerous situation with crew still on the grid. There was obviously riders moving their bikes off the grid. There was the funny scene of Maverick Viñales running down the grid with no bike, not knowing what's going on. Mike Webb, in my opinion, was completely right to throw the red flag out and just stop everything from happening, because obviously it was clearly an unprecedented, he described it as an unprecedented situation, something that he had never seen before, which I think is more than understandable. Safety is the number one concern. You've got to throw the red flag if you've got riders running down the grid as if everything is normal, when it's not, you kind of have to throw the red, right?
And don't forget that the pit lane was full of people.
Mm.
People from the teams.
Absolutely.
So also guests. So it was a tricky situation. And again, I really, I agree with you that showing the red flag was the right call.
I think it's the only, I fully agree. I think it's the only decision you can make. It's just too dangerous and too volatile a situation. Like, it's, I have to say, I know this didn't work out for Mark in the end, and ultimately his plan was incorrect because of, obviously, either he didn't know or he'd forgotten about the regulation change we had after Japan last year, where it's now a ride-through if, because to clarify the situation, the rules now state once the three-minute board goes up, you're locked into your tire choice. If you're locked, at the three-minute board, your tire choice is locked in. If you change after that, it's a ride-through penalty off the start. So, that was the rule that changed going into this season after what happened in Japan last year. You kind of have to admire Yuri that Mark was just thinking this far ahead and had this deeper plan while on the grid minutes out before a Grand Prix, because most people are just sitting there nervous thinking about the race itself. Mark's out here plotting some sort of evil villain scheme to try and trick the grid into thinking he's going to start the race on wet tires. Because you've got to remember, he's starting from pole position. The whole grid can see him and they can see what he's going to do.
Yeah,
and of course, when Marc Márquez, who was won here seven times, is expected to win an eighth, is going to make a last-minute call, people are going to follow, right?
Well, that's another example about, first, how influential is that?
Yeah, I'd say so.
is he on the rest of the grid? And not only it's our feeling, but also the rest of the riders said afterwards, after the race, they were just focused on what Mark was doing. Even Pecco, Pedro Acosta, Bastianini, Di Gianantonio, all of the others that were on wet spec bikes were thinking, okay, I'm just going to follow this guy because he has given us so hard times on the past by following different strategy. So it's the right one to look at and to follow. So yeah, most of them were following Mark. So I think it's another example of how competitive this guy is and how clear he had it in mind, despite he was wrong about the penalty that he would have got. And yeah, it's another example. And it also shows that this kind of, let's say, character, this kind of rider is able to push the boundaries of everybody. I mean, the riders, his team, also the regulations, because now he has forced a situation where a race direction, the Grand Prix Commission will have to look deep into the regulations because, again, I believe it's not, let's say, fair for the three only riders that made the right gamble and choose to start with the dry setup and slick tires.
That was going to be my next question, funnily enough, because, yeah, you're absolutely right. But Bastianini, Agüero, and Brad Binder, as you mentioned, were the only three riders on the grid that had slicks on, ready to go. And they weren't the cause of any of the chaos and the drama. They ultimately made the right decision. And as a result of the chaos that happened in that start, they've not been rewarded for it because that red flag invalidated everything. And then everybody who was on wet switched to slicks for the second restart. So if anything, their gamble was completely cancelled out. So, I mean, obviously the big parties, the commissions, the themselves, they've got to sit down and probably just close this loophole in the regulations. But what do you think happens next year? Because we've already had a little bit of a rumblings from like Mike Webb coming out saying we've got to sit down and discuss this and discuss what happens next. I mean, is they've got to close that loophole up, surely, or maybe just refine what's in the regulation to say, hey, maybe for example, they could say, once the 3-minute board is up, you can't switch bikes, or something along those lines.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's let's say it's impossible to don't allow people to move or to do something. It's just that you need to make clear that the penalty will be reasonable and that the outcome that the others had or have, like Enea, Brad, and it's fair. So what it's what I would say that they need to change is that balance. I mean, they need to be the ones getting more benefit from their choice. So it's a complex thing. And that's why I think that it's good for the championship because the regulations are, the championship is alive. We on Austin, we've been in, so particular and unique scenario. And now they just need to put a plan in place in order to have an answer when this kind of scenario happens again.
Yeah, maybe a ride-through penalty might be a bit too strong. Maybe make it a double long lap, like a jump start might be, for example. I don't know. I don't envy anyone that's got to make these regulations because it's obviously an incredibly difficult thing to do, to come up with rules or to change and tweak rules to make it as fair as you possibly can, because fares as a subjective argument in the first place.
Exactly.
But,
that's
a thing. It's incredibly hard to be able to do that. But yeah, good luck to the regulators on that one. Before we move on to the aftermath of that chaotic start, we're very lucky that the boys at the Motorsport Network who were over here in Texas were able to sit down and have an interview with 1993 MotoGP World Champion and Hall of Famer Kevin Schwartz, and we're going to play that interview in this episode in Tank Slappers as a little extra bonus for you. So here it is right now. We'll be back right after this.
Do you think that Mark's performance has put the things back on its place in MotoGP?
You know, I think Mark Marquez is back fit. He's got on one of the best team's bike out there, and he's making the most of it. Right now, he's going to be very difficult to catch. I think everybody's got a lot of work to do to try and catch up to him. But once again, we saw almost several mistakes over the weekend. You know, one was crash in the rain, and then a pretty big moment yesterday in the sprint race. Anything can happen. It's racing, the pressure from other riders, hopefully not any contact from other riders, but, you know, it's never going to be easy, but Mark right now, I think, is the top of the heap.
How might this dominance be affecting Pecco?
You know, Pecco has been the lead guy at Ducati for, what, 5 years, 6 years now? His bike is following his path in development. He's obviously developed a really good bike, maybe one he doesn't like so much, but one that Mark Marquez really, really enjoys riding. So it's got to be tough on Pecco. The last person you want to get beat by is your teammate. You know, and Pecco's doing his best, trying to score points every weekend, which is what he needs to keep doing until he finds what it is with that Ducati that's going to give him that confidence to step up and give Mark a big push.
And do you believe that he can turn this situation around?
Yeah, I mean, it may not be this weekend in Texas. It may not be next weekend. Wherever we go next, Doha, but you know, anything's possible. You know, both the bikes are similar, so Pecco's got to realize that, you know, I think I'm as good a rider as Mark. I have the same equipment. I've got to find what's going to give me that confidence, and then I can start giving him some, you know, throw some challenges his direction. Anyway, maybe not beating him straight away, but pressuring for the first half of the race instead of just the first lap or two. You know, get good starts, get in the front, make him find his way around you. There's always a chance that Mark's going to make a mistake too. You know, I hope that's not the case, but you know, racing, trying to pass at that level is never easy.
What has surprised you the most, Mark's performance or Alex's performance?
I think probably Alex's performance. You know, I think Alex was showing us the end of last season that he had the speed here and there. But I mean, consistently, this morning he was P6, P7, I think the furthest back I've seen him in any practice session or qualifying. I think Alex Marquez has really stepped up this year. And maybe he doesn't like getting beat by his brother, so he's pushing hard as well.
Are you concerned about this, Mark's overwhelming dominance could lead to a decline in the interest of the championship?
You know, there's always that possibility, but I think I heard someone describe it this morning. You know, it's almost as makes it even more exciting to see if he can continue to win. I know us as racers don't want to see that. We want to see good competition at the front. But I'm sure Mark's dad loves seeing Mark and Alex at the front. The whole Marquez family must be just totally overwhelmed with how well they're doing. And, you know, let's see how long the dominance lasts.
What are the key factors for MotoGP to succeed again in the United States?
Well, I mean, we need riders in MotoGP, not just Moto2 and Moto3. You know, we have one rider now. We have Christian Daniel in Rookies Cup. We have you know, some young American kids that are 14, not quite old enough for Rookies Cup yet. Mikey Sanchez is one. We've got some young kids that I think are doing the right things and going down the right avenues to eventually end up in MotoGP. But it's just going to take a little time. You know, young kids like 14, it's going to be, you know, 6 or 8 or 10 years before we see them actually maybe make it to MotoGP if that's where they deserve to end up.
And how does the Moto America Talent Cup can contribute?
You know, it's the opportunity for those young kids to race together. You know, it's a similar bike to what Moto 3 or pre-Moto 3. I know the speeds aren't nearly as fast as Moto 3 bikes are here, but this also their first race. I'll keep a close eye on the American Talent Cup and see one kid really starts to stand out. You know, maybe that kid deserves an opportunity to go do a test with a pre-Moto 3 team or go over and do some Spanish championship racing. You know, just have to wait and see. Once again, it's not anything that we have a quick fix for. I don't see anybody there that's 16 or 17 or 18 that I think could go to that next level and immediately start being competitive in Moto 3 or Moto 2.
What do you think Liberty Media can bring into the sport?
You know, what they did for Formula One seems to attract absolutely a completely new range of fans that Formula One's never had before. I have friends that call me and say, hey, I want to go to F1. I was like, I didn't even know you knew anything about motorsport. I watched The Drive to Survive. You know, it's the greatest show I've ever seen. I'm really interested in Formula One now. So, you know, they get on board and do some big stuff like that. I think Liberty has intentions of maybe more than one U.S. Grand Prix, trying to create more excitement around MotoGP. We just have one race and we're convinced that the attendance isn't enough here that we need more than one, but maybe three Grand Prix, two or three Grand Prix is the answer, and more people will start going to different venues and seeing different stuff.
Regarding that, there are some rumors about venues like Barber Motorsports or Palm Springs. Do you know anything about that?
I haven't heard anything about those. I was just sat in the commentary booth with Justin Marks, and he mentioned the track in Knoxville, Tennessee, just outside of Knoxville. And Tilke helped with the design of it. It's a work in progress right now. It may be a couple of years before it's a venue that's ready. But I think there's quite a few opportunities out there, places that could host a Grand Prix with maybe just a few changes to the facility.
Changing the subject a bit, Japanese manufacturers are hiring more and more European engineers and managers. How realistic do you think it is for them to make the transition and return to fighting for victories?
I think Ducati and Aprilia both have taught the Japanese quite a few things, KTM as well. You have to try lots of different things. There's not just one correct way, and the more avenues that you test, the more opportunity you have for success. It's also the more opportunity you have for failure. But the Japanese have always been so regimented in their, when they get headed a certain direction, this is the direction we're going. Whereas I think the European-based teams and engineers have much more open mind and want to try different things. You get four or six really good riders on your bikes, you have that much more data, that much more input from riders to be able to confirm whether your testing is the right direction or not. So, hats off to the Euros. They've done a great job. And the Japanese are slowly closing the door. Maybe it's from those European engineers that they're bringing on board. So we'll just have to wait and see. I'm impressed with Honda and Yamaha so far this year. Aprilia seems to be the bike that's struggling maybe the most, at least here at COTA. And there's no doubt they miss having the world champion on their bike. So can't wait to see Jorge Martin come back.
There's a big change in the regulations in 2027. Do you think that a return to the sports roots is necessary?
I don't know exactly what the changes are for 27, but I know I've heard that everybody's excited about they're going to be less of this and less of that, and to take the motorcycles back to being more normal, not normal, but less elaborate equipment. And, I think the racing has suffered a little bit because of it. I think we've got bikes that are aerodynamically, you can't one follow the other. It starts to overheat. The tires get too hot. There's too many, there's too much going on with the motorcycles. When my bike's not as fast as the bike in front of me, I have to stay in the draft. That's the only way I can hang on. And then I try and make challenges going into corners, into different sections of the racetrack. But with all the aero that the bikes have and all the complications they have with tire pressures and temperatures and all of that. They need to simplify things a little bit, I think.
Don't you think that 2027, with this regulation change, might be a good opportunity for a brand like Suzuki to thinking on coming back?
I'd love to see Suzuki back in Grand Prix racing. 2027 and a new set of rules. You know, maybe they just dust off the bike from 2020 and bring it back out, and maybe that's exactly what the class specifications are. Maybe they have to make a few changes, but, you know, I think that's still a long way off, and, you know, hopefully Suzuki has the desire and the want to come back to Grand Prix racing, you know, if MotoGP will allow it.
And the last one, how hard must be for the current world champion to stay away from the racing with the number one plate?
You know, for Jorge, it's got to have been really, really difficult. You know, 13 laps of testing, hurt, went home, finally starts to feel good enough that he can go do some riding again, gets hurt again, missing the first three Grand Prix as the first three Grand Prix as a world champion. It's difficult. You know, I broke my arm leading up to the start of the season, 3 weeks before the first race. So I showed up at the first race not fit. Two races later, I'm still racing in Japanese. I finally get to win. But Jorge, he's got to get back on that bike now that he's fit, and he's got to get mentally and physically back to going over 200 miles an hour again. The time, I used to say when I was injured, the time away from racing, it took me three times that to get back to where I was when I got hurt. So, you know, it's never going to be easy, and that's, you know, much of what we've seen with Marc Marquez. He took a long time off, and it's taken him a long time to work his way back to where he is now. So I think Martin's doing the right thing. He's taking time. He's getting fit. Physically, the hands and the feet are the two, you know, key elements in being able to control a bike. And you want those to be 100%, especially on modern-day MotoGP machinery.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Just wanted to say as well a big thank you to Charlotte, who put that together for us on our video editing team. She's an absolute angel. She probably went through about 16 cups of tea putting that together, but she's done an exceptional job as ever. Yeah, you know, she's an absolute tea merchant, goes through it like crazy. She just drains the office supply, but we love Charlotte. Thank you, Charlotte, for putting that together for us. Much, much appreciated.
100%. Thank you very much.
The direct aftermath of that was that it was still looking like it was going to be a Marc Marquez dominant victory. He has a couple of seconds. He's pulling away from Bagnaia, a couple of attempts per lap, got a comfortable lead. Bagnaia is second. Alex Marquez is third. It's all going, oh, here we go again. Marc Marquez is going to win in Austin. He's going to make it 8 wins in Texas, 3 on the bounce to start the season. Then next thing you know, oh, he's tucked the front, and turn 5, and down he goes, and just like that, the run of perfection is over, and it basically gift-wraps Pecco Bagnaia, his first Grand Prix win of the season, Yuri. And first of all, how big a shock was that? And, well, if you're Mark, just an unforced error, really, to let Pecco in like that.
Yeah, I think that after the race, Mark was completely, I would say, fully furious with himself, because don't forget that since Thursday, he was, voicing out the danger of being a bit so overconfident. One of the first things that he said on Thursday was, I know that everybody looks at me as the favorite at this track, but don't forget that I've made big mistakes here. He pointed out at 2019, which he, let's say, names or identifies as his best season in MotoGP ever. And he said, the only big mistake that I made was here, when he crashed from the lead. Mm. It happened again. But don't forget that on Friday, he made a misjudgment of the track conditions when it was pouring down and the surface was completely wet. And he crashed big time. It was a dangerous one. It was a super spectacular one.
Oh, yeah.
He was fine. But it was another heads up. Then, in the sprint, he was... I don't even know how he managed to stay on the bike.
It's a ridiculous save.
Exactly. And then, so not only Mark saying to himself, be quiet, be careful, be careful, be careful, but having those two moments, and then on Sunday race, bang, he crashed again. So in a way, it was a bit, okay, now what? I ask him. I mean, you've been repeating to yourself and voicing out that you needed to stay relaxed and to pay an extra attention. And then it happened again. So that's why I think that he was super, super furious with himself.
I can imagine why. I mean, it's like you said, he'd been warned. He had that big crash in Friday practice when the rain came down. Had the massive near miss during the sprint race on the opening lap, where that bike was sideways going through turn 18, and not in the good way either. Somehow saved that one, didn't crash, would win the sprint. And then, yeah, just takes too much curb into turn five. And you could see in the laps running up to it, he was taking that curb just fine. And he didn't need to take that level of risk, is the point I'm getting at here. He had a 2 second plus lead on Bagnaia. He was managing the gap perfectly. It was very similar to the sprint where, again, Alex was close, but Mark was managing the gap. Didn't need to take any real liberties or any real risk. He didn't have to go at 100% to be in control of the race as it played out. And now he's crashed. Pecco Bagnaia has won this race, and now he's only 11 points off the championship lead again. It could have been 36. Instead, it's now 11. It's a huge swing. And just like that, Yuri, Pecco Bagnaia is back in the conversation for the championship again.
Yeah, the last thing I would like to point out about what happened to Mark is that I would love to know, and it's something that we need to ask him, is if this crash, well, we all know why this crash happened. It was because he changed his line just 5 centimeters. So he went, let's say, 5 centimeters in the curve, in compared with all the laps before. But what it would be cool to know is if this move was 1A for being, I would say, a bit relaxed, or B, because he was attacking.
It's a good question. Did he feel like he had to put that gap out because it was Pecco in second, or was it because he was just too casual with it, thinking I've got this 2 second lead, it's fine, I'm just lost concentration, and maybe that's what led to the error. I'd love to know. It's a very intriguing. I'd love to know what was going through his head at that point in time. That would actually be very interesting.
It turns me back to 20. In 2020, when he had this crash in Jerez, the crash that starts all his nightmare, you remember that he made that mistake going off track. He went back in again. And then he made this exceptional, let's say, out of this world comeback.
Yeah.
And then when he was P3, he relaxed a bit. And then he had the crash. So I think, yeah, it's. I'm curious to find out if it was because of this or because he was in, let's say, attack mode. But anyway, we will find it out in a few days.
Yes, yeah, well, we may be able to ask the man himself about that in the coming days. Watch this space, shall we say, on the Motorsport Network and Tank Slappers for more on that around the Qatar Grand Prix. You heard it here first. But there's a few things that have come about as a result of that result, Yuri. Obviously, Pecco Bagnaia now right back in contention again, only 11 points off the championship lead. So let me get this straight. We have an independent rider on top of the championship. He's riding a light blue colored Ducati, a Gresini, as a matter of fact. He's not won a Grand Prix yet so far this year, but has finished second on all six major results this year. He's and his surname is Marquez, but it's not Mark. It's Alex Marquez that now leads the championship by a single point. Would you have ever guessed, going into March, that three rounds in, Alex Marquez would legitimately be leading the world championship? It's a remarkable story, isn't it?
I mean, he's been doing the right things. I mean, yesterday, after the race, we went out here in Austin. We always try to, after all the work. And then we were with him. And he seems super relaxed. I mean, because Mark went straight back to Spain. But I think Alex wanted to celebrate his lead of the championship, and this guy says, I mean, he's enjoying the moment. He's doing the right things, and also coming back into Mark's scene that we just talked about. Don't forget that on that video that we were talking about. Mark only asked for two riders. What's having Pecco on the bike and what Alex? So even Mark thinks that his brother is, I'm not gonna say title contender or, but is somebody to look at.
To
focus on, because he's doing the right things. That's what exactly Alex is doing at the moment. He's doing better than his brother. Less mistakes, more solid, less crashes, less savings. So I think it shows that it's something to talk about. And I spoke with Davide Tardozzi over the race weekend, and it was just, we met at the paddock, and Davide is always super nice. And I asked to him about Alex. And don't forget that Davide is in charge, is the team manager only of the red bikes, the Ducati factory team. So he's, I don't know if jurisdiction is the right word, but it's only the Ducati Lenovo team. He's nothing to do with all the others, because, for example, Gigi Dalligna, the general manager, is in charge of everything. But Davide is only focused on the red garage. So I asked him about Alex, and he said, look, Uri, Alex has been doing like this all his career. He is maybe not as fast as others to arrive, but when he gets there and he has the situation under control, man, it's super hard to get him down from there. It's super hard. So that's what we're having. He's just flowing. He says that I'm flowing. I'm happy. I'm comfortable. So, with this mentality, I think it will be very hard for the others to grab him.
I mean, it summed it up very nicely when he was being interviewed in the media after the race, and he says, we've got to enjoy the moment, because I don't think even he would have figured going into this year that he'd be leading the championship after three races. And you've seen the social media clips, like the Gresini Racing Team are a very laid back, very close team, and you could see the videos of them playing the music, blaring out the song Follow the Leader in the garage, because Alex is now a champion and he's dancing. And just wait to see what happens when he actually wins one of these things. It's going to be an absolutely ridiculous celebration, I can tell you that for sure. But six races, three sprints, three Grand Prix, six second places. May not be the fastest guy out there right now, but he's been the most consistent so far, and consistency wins championships. So I can't say I'm hugely surprised, but just the step forward that Alex has made this year on that GP24 has been remarkable.
And let's see what it implies for the future, because don't forget that he's not racing with the last spec Ducati bike. So let's see what happens. As far as I know, Ducati is very, let's say, loyal and very respectful with the contracts that it has on place. And they have signed with BR46 for this third factory bike. But I'm convinced that Alex will push and try to make Ducati doubt about this choice, and also Gresini will push as hard as possible, try to get this factory bike for the future, despite we know that there's a contract on place and it's difficult to break these kind of things.
Certainly one to keep an eye on, because if Alex keeps doing this, he's going to make a very strong argument that he should be the one on the extra GP25 if he's performing this well. And it's not like it was a bad weekend from the man who was on the other GP25, because Fabio Di Giantonio got his first Grand Prix podium of the year. He finished in third on the NFL-inspired VR46 livery. If you're into your American football, you probably appreciated that one. But another podium for VR46, Yuri. That team is going very well at the moment. Both their riders, third and fourth, consistent up there. DJ Antonio was right next to Alex Marquez on track as well. So again, just good results and good consistency from the Rossi team so far. They've taken a step forward again this year, definitely.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, what was not expected, let's say, is Alex. But we were expecting that from BR46. The problem is that Fabio got injured in the preseason, and then he started the season in not 100%. Even here in Texas, he didn't want to give us a straight answer, but he was struggling with the shoulder. He was struggling a lot with the shoulder. So he couldn't even move his shoulder at some point because of all the effort. So he's still getting there, and yeah, it's hard. So heads off to what he has been through and how he has emerged, raised from that situation. And regarding Morbidelli, same. I mean, he's pushing. He's doing a very good job. And yeah, I think again the surprise is Alex, because without Alex, it would be everything a bit more, let's say, expected, or let's say logical.
Yeah, we were expecting this to be a two bike championship going in. I think it was fair to say going into the season itself, everybody thought it was going to just be Pecco versus Marquez, or maybe just Marquez dominates everything. But Alex has earned the right to be in this conversation from his performances so far. And again, the other Ducati's not a million miles away. Even before he crashed, Fermin Aldeguer was running P5 at a certain point. So all the Ducatis out there are seemingly getting to grips with their new bikes well and performing well. I mean, we were very nearly do a top five lockout, but sadly Fermin Aldeguer crashed out towards the end. But it did open up fifth place for Jack Miller, who is probably a bit of a specialist in these sorts of changeable conditions and making the most of what was difficult to navigate weather. And the Yamaha's not been particularly great in race trim so far. But great ride from Jack Miller, and great to see him on the top five of Yamaha.
Yeah. We were talking with him after the race, and he said, "Look, I'm super happy of being back at the Pramac. I think it's a very, very, let's say, relaxed environment." Sorry, completely opposite than the KTM. So he feels himself at home. So also the Yamaha, I mean, he's giving some heads up to Fabio as well, because now Fabio knows that there's another Yamaha rider being so fast, and then, I mean, he needs to I wouldn't say wake up, because Fabio's been there pushing like hell, but I mean, it's another reference point, and somebody that can, I mean, you need to stay sharp. And again, it's also important for Alex Rins, especially for Alex Rins, because Alex is in a very difficult situation there. And also Miguel is out. He's injured. But I think Alex Rins is under big pressure here. So having Jack Miller there, it means that Alex needs to do something different, needs to wake up.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, the Yamaha...
The bike is hard to ride, it, but... Yeah, it's hard. It's hard. I mean, he needs to do something different and he needs to react as soon as possible because otherwise, it will be... And don't forget that now Yamaha manages four riders. Four of the riders of the Yamaha, I mean, the full crew is managed by Yamaha. And I don't want to put on the table what Red Bull has recently done with Yuki and Liam Lawson, but maybe... it wouldn't surprise me if somebody in the MotoGP grid thinks, maybe we should consider these kind of things. As I'm not saying that it's going to happen, but as a measure of pressure, to put pressure on some riders, say, listen, you have a contract, but we have room to play.
I didn't think Yuki Tsunoda and Liam Lawson would be referenced on this podcast, but Yuri's showing his range. I love that. I can't say it's surprising. Alex Rins has gone into this season as the man under pressure. Contract year, he has to fight to keep his place on the grid. He's obviously struggled since obviously that horrific leg injury, but there's no getting around it. He's been the worst of the Yamaha so far, and Jack Miller is largely impressed by how well he's taken to the Yamaha, how well he's adapted to it. And yes, the bike is difficult, but Miller's done more than his fair share of strong results on the Yamaha, and he's compared himself more to Fabio than he has to Rins. And definitely one to keep an eye on as the year goes on, because like I said, Rins is in a contract year, could be difficult for him. One more person talking about difficulty at the moment here before we get out of here as well is Johan Mir, who was running in the top 10 again, but crashed again. And I did the numbers on this. 5 DNFs in the last 7 races for Mir. I think it's 12 out of the last 23 Grand Prix, over 50%. Of Grand Prix since the start of last season he's crashed in. At what point does this start becoming a real concern now? Because it's not like Honda is slow anymore. They've got a good bike here now. Zarco was again in the top 6 when he crashed out late on. But the Honda is not bad anymore. It's clearly a competitive machine again. It's not great, but it's good enough where it's now in the top 10 regularly. And you can't afford to have all these crashes now, right?
Yeah, but I'm gonna make a gamble here,
okay.
And people would might think that I'm losing my mind. But I would say that when you say how did you articulate that question? For how much is gonna
how much
last
pressure? You know,
yeah, I would say not anymore.
Okay,
because. In my opinion, and talking to Honda and then, of course, I say that, and next week, Mir is fired. But I will keep my... I hope not as well. I don't think this is happening. But what I would say is that, I mean, it's not the same. I mean, all the stats are stats, so are 100% facts, true. But what I would say is that it's not the same crashing, fighting for the 17th place... that crashing, fighting for the 6th, 7th. So I would say that Honda has made the biggest improvement on the grid this year, 100%.
100%.
So Mir is starting to feel, to have, I would say, I don't know, the mojo back. So he's starting to feel himself as the racer that he was in Suzuki, being aggressive, being there. He is happy to race again. Last year, he was thinking on retiring.
Mm.
He was thinking on retiring from racing. He was not open about it, but believe me, he was thinking on, say, what am I doing here? I don't have any reason to come back to races. He has a family. He has a son. wife a, let's say, happy life in Mallorca. So what was the point? Now, he's sharp again. Why? Because he knows that Honda, step by step, is able to give him the tools to be the racer that he was in the past. So that's where I think that the all the energy is positive there in the Honda garage.
No, that's fair enough. It's a very valid point that, I guess, I'm glad that Honda has seen the bigger picture. That, yes, okay, the crashes aren't ideal, but at least we're crashing from 7th rather than 17th. It's a big difference there. And, I mean, yeah, it would have been a horrible...
Don't get me wrong. Get me wrong. He was super frustrated.
I can imagine. Yeah, totally.
But he was frustrated in a different way than he was last year.
A good kind of frustration rather than a I might retire at 26 kind of frustrating, which would have obviously been a horrible story for bike racing. If Yoann Mir, a world champion in his own right, is retiring from bike racing and from Honda at 26 years of age. He's 27 now, but that would just be, it would be another Casey.
Yeah, I'm not trying to make a story about that, you know? So
I know where you're getting at. I mean, it's just imagining it would have been just, it's just not nice. Yeah,
100%.
To deal with that.
Some point, he has been open with me in the precision test, which I was, wow. So he openly talked about, said, he said last year, I was thinking, what's the point of coming here?
Yeah.
I didn't want to. It was hard for me to come to travel to the races. So, and talking a bit with his entourage, they said, yeah, it was hard. I mean, he was thinking about it. I mean, not about, okay, I'm going to retire in 1 month or this, but he was saying, well, maybe it's a bit pointless to be here if we don't have any light at the end of the tunnel. Now, they are starting to see the light. So let's go for it.
I am fortunate enough to host another podcast on my own with Motorsport 101 with my colleague Cameron Buckley, and he's a huge Honda fan, and he said to me, Dre, Honda are never bad for long. And he wasn't wrong in that one. It's good to see Honda back to somewhere near the front of the field again, and the Honda competitive again, and I'm glad it's getting a spark again out of Yoann Mir. And Luca Marini, who had his best ever finish on that Honda since joining the team as well. So yeah, good positive signs to take away from Honda, even if they've not had maybe the full results to show for it just yet. But that'll just about do it for this episode of Tank Slappers here from Austin, Texas. Big thanks to Yuri as ever for joining me. Get a safe flight back home, mate, in about 3 hours' time. So he's going to be scrambling to the airport as soon as I stop recording here. But we'll be back after the Qatar Grand Prix in a week and a half's time. Keep your eyes peeled around the Motorsport Network as well. There might be some interesting videos and content wrapped around a certain rider in red. Stay tuned for more on that. Until then, I've been Dre Harrison. He's been Yuri Pidgeon. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next time on Tank Slappers. Take care.